The talk tonight, in the talk tonight, we'll take up the chapter in Mizuno's book, Basic Buddhist Concepts, called The Pathway to Faith. And I'll try to talk about how we view faith and how we practice faith in terms of Buddhism, in terms of Soto Zen. It's an interesting title for a chapter, The Pathway to Faith, and not inappropriate, I think, in terms of the way that I understand my practice. It's interesting because in one sense practice is the pathway of faith. And so we're not really going to faith, although, as I say, it's not inappropriate to talk about it as the pathway to faith. So let me explain what I mean. Up until this point, we've been talking about dependent origination and causality. And those are principles, and the principles that we've been talking about are, in a sense, universal. They're, in a sense, natural principles that you can observe just in your life, in the daily life of human beings. In this particular society, causality on a sort of scientific level, social and scientific level, is really important. And the lines of causality are really important for us to find out in terms of science, in terms of understanding how things work. And it is also true that causality on a religious level is important. In terms of meditation practice, we are asking ourselves to do an activity which is not rationally apparent. So in other words, you come to the temple and you say, okay, well, the first thing you want to do is learn how to meditate. And what does that mean? It means sit down and let go of whatever's arising in your body and mind. Look at this wall. Basically, sit there and look at the wall. Not terribly rational. But if we are willing to take that initial step of faith and just do that thing, which is different than we would intuitively think, if we take that initial step, then some effect arises as a result of taking that step. So in other words, we've stepped off into the unknown in faith and done a thing and then waited to see, in a sense, what the consequence of that action is. And that condition of stepping off into the unknown in faith is what I mean by the path of faith. That Buddhism is a path of faith. Because in a way, that is where we're constantly pointed back to by our practice. That position of taking a step into the unknown in faith, seeing what the consequences are. It is important, and the way that the Buddha Dharma and the Buddha is different from other traditions, other ways of looking at things, that causality is intimately related to our practice of faith. So we're not just saying, have faith and don't worry about it. Have faith and X, Y, or Z. We're saying, have faith, see what the consequences of that are. Examine it yourself. See in your own life what the consequences of acting on faith are. in the beginning, we say that will lead you to a place, that will lead you to some understanding, that will lead you to enlightenment, acting in that way. Of course, then in our tradition, in the Soto Zen tradition, we say practice is enlightenment. And in fact, that action of faith, that action of being willing to step off into nowhere, into nothing, into the unknown, that is right where the where our enlightenment is expressed. And so we're going toward the place where we begin to live in that place of faith, where we begin to just dwell in that place of faith, where we're just willing to let go of whatever arises in our minds and hearts and bodies, our lives. We just continually step into that place of letting go. And that's what it means that it's the path to faith. Because there is a transition that happens. You can see it in people as they learn practice and as they go on in practice. You can see they've now crossed the Rubicon and they're living in faith. They're just having faith and going on. And that changes the character of a person's life. It changes how you live. It just takes as long as it takes until you make that transition. And in a way, we're always making that transition. We're always just stepping into that place where I'm now living in faith. And no matter what, again, it's not blind faith. It's aware faith. It's faith that is keenly examining what's going on in the present moment. What is this? What is going on? What's going on? What's this? Just sitting still in that place of letting go and looking. Looking and seeing what's going on. The Buddha Dharma starts off in a very simple and straightforward place. In this chapter, he reminds us of the threefold doctrine, which is that the three aspects of the threefold doctrine are the practice of generosity, giving; the practice of keeping the five precepts, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, don't misuse sexuality.
Don't encourage intoxication.
Oh, yeah. Don't encourage or take intoxicants. Thank you. If you do those two practices, you'll be reborn into heaven. There will be a good consequence from your actions. This is how the Buddha says, take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, put these into practice, and you will prove it true for yourself. He's basically saying, so the outset of Buddhism is based in causality. If you do good, you'll get good consequences. If you do evil, you'll get evil consequences. You'll get suffering. Very simple, very straightforward. And then as you go along, put those things into practice, complexities inevitably arise, the complexities of life. There's the great story of Angulimala. He was a man who was a murderer, basically. And the Buddha encountered him when Angulimala was going to murder the Buddha, just because he happened to be the next person along on the path where Angulimala was walking. The Buddha was able to stop him and show him that the path that he was following was not good. He was able to help Angulimala to stop his impulse to kill people. So Angulimala converts to the Dharma, becomes a monk, actually becomes an arhat, and great, so he really penetrates deeply into practice. And he goes out and he's on alms round, And the people where he's begging for alms remember him from when he was a murderer, and they basically stone him. They throw rocks at him, and he goes back to the Buddha all bloody and, you know, kind of beaten up because these people. And he tells the Buddha what's happened, and the Buddha basically says, you know, bear it. Because the Buddha knows this is the consequence of his former action. So Angulimala has effectively said, okay, I'm going to be generous, and I'm going to keep the five precepts with the knowledge that that consequence will get me reborn into heaven. But at the same time, he still has to work out the consequences of his former wrong actions. So there's a complexity. How do I handle that? How do I handle the arising of my former wrong actions? What do I do with that? How do I come to understand that? There's a kind of way in which the inquiry of our experience, looking at our experience, looking at the consequences of our experience, helps us to kind of corkscrew into the truth, into a deeper understanding of the truth. How do I find peace of mind in the present circumstances, in my present circumstances? And that's really a more subtle way of asking that same question. How do I live with the consequences of my former actions? How do I find peace of mind in this present moment? Meditation, the precepts, a deeper understanding. That's practice. We keep stepping off into faith. Keep encountering this place. I don't really know what is going on. I don't see what's true. I don't see what is good. Step off into faith. What does the Dharma teach us? Be still. Keep the precepts to the best of our ability. Go forward with an open and trusting heart. Learn from our experience. The life of faith in this way could also be talked about as a life of trust. It is not our immediate impulse, particularly maybe, I don't know, in our modern society, trust is not easily given. It's not easily practiced. We learn trust by trusting, and in a way it's the same as what I've described about the living the life of faith. We trust the Dharma, we trust the Buddha, because what he's basically doing, what the Buddha's basically doing is saying, here, try this action, see how it works for you. I can't force you to do it, it's your voluntary action. But give it a shot. And through putting the teachings into practice, we begin to say, oh, he's on to something here. And we develop our trust in that way. But trust in that same way of faith also has the quality of stepping off into the unknown. Sometime the Buddha is going to ask you to do something that you may not think is all that great an idea. And I'm not talking about going contrary to the precepts. Most likely it just is facing some fear that we have, looking within and facing a fear.
Would you say it's like asking us to be willing to let whatever is go, is one of the things that he's asking?
Yes. That is, in fact, the thing that he's asking. And in my own experience, I think I could fairly characterize myself as being not terribly idealistic, but attached to a principled life. And there was a point in my practice where I was, in a way, asked to set that aside, set aside my sense of what integrity means, let it go. And that was a pretty, it's a pretty tricky place to find yourself. And in my case, I felt like I was in a reasonable enough place where I could actually do that, set aside my own mind, in a way, my own thinking, and go forward, not necessarily in faith or attachment to those around me, but in trust, in trusting the meditation practice, in trusting the Dharma, trusting the truth of the principle, everything can be let go of, everything needs to be let go of. And in stepping beyond that place of, in a way, letting go of my own integrity, and again, I didn't do anything illegal or immoral. I was just in a place that was really pretty uncomfortable and needed to, in a way, let go of my external resistance to a situation which I couldn't change anyway. I was able to find a different way of relating to that integrity, and a way of going forward which actually ended up being able to preserve my integrity as well as more flexibly deal with the circumstance that I was in, and to not be, and because I was able to let go of being rigid about something, about the thing, then I was able to not be hurt by the situation. This is a little bit vague, and but best I can do. What I'm trying to get at is that the degree to which we are able, which the Dharma and the practice enables us to let go of our experience in our mind, is profound. That there's a profound level in which the self can be set aside and let go of, and that's a true process. That's a process that's in accord with truth. And so to be open to that possibility, this is not an everyday occurrence, but to be open to the possibility enables us to go forward and to continue to go more deeply into practice. To be willing to see what we're afraid of, to let go of what we're afraid of, to see self when it arises, and to let go of self when it arises, to go forward. And to trust that the consequence of practicing the Dharma, the consequence of following this path, will be positive. It's a positive consequence. We think that when we let go of some aspect of self, that we're going to lose something. When we step off into the real unknown, we're going to damage or lose or be hurt or find ourselves in an empty place. But this is not the effect of the Dharma. The effect of the Dharma is to find the cessation of suffering. There's a great story from the Pali Canon, which the Buddha has explained to someone the bliss of final emancipation, or the bliss of some final stage of meditation. He's telling people, yeah, it feels great. And somebody who's listening to him is a Brahmin or something like that, and he's saying, well, nirvana, that's emptiness, that's cessation, that can't be good, that can't feel good. And the Buddha says, sort of very kindly, I've been there and you haven't. I know what it feels like and you don't. It is blissful. And in a way, we can we build up trust in the Buddha. We build up trust in our own capacity to know what the Buddha knew. We build up trust in what the Buddha taught until we are able to make that final step to just letting go of self, letting go of everything. And it takes as long as it takes. The Buddha is very patient. The Buddha nature is very patient. And we can be very patient. So, as we've talked about in earlier talks, trust, faith, are in the doctrines of no self, anicca, and the doctrine of the existence of enlightenment. We know that suffering exists. We can prove to ourselves that anicca is true, that impermanence is true. We can prove to ourselves that there is no separate self. And by proving to ourselves in a profound way that impermanence and there is no separate self are true, we come to know that enlightenment exists. We come to know that there is a positive consequence for training. So then, just to recap, causality, you know, be generous, keep the precepts, enlightenment exists, act, and then causality exists. We do the practice, we see what the consequence is. That is the action of faith. That's what leads us to a cyclically deepening experience of faith. Putting the teaching into practice, stepping off into the unknown, we come to understand a deeper understanding of the truth. And this enables us to step off onto the unknown and to continue to put ourselves in that place of not knowing. So, that's what I have to say this evening. Any questions?
Well, I feel like it's a just kind of an interesting distinction between, I guess, your definition of faith and the way faith is often viewed in, you know, the West, I guess, is here it kind of seems like faith is sort of defined by rigidity in spite of experience or in spite of other things. Where you're defining faith as a deepening towards openness, I guess, to experience, and kind of, you know, a way of where that other faith is kind of, I guess, in a sense, tints the lens in which we see where this type of faith is actually trying to clear it up a little bit, if that makes sense.
There's a great emphasis in the Abrahamic traditions on belief and belief in doctrine. And a little bit as helpful in terms of Buddhist practice, but it's not really that critical. It's not terribly important at all that you believe in a particular doctrine. What the Buddha's main intention is for us to prove the practice true. And the kind of faith that I'm talking about is actually practiced in Western religious traditions. When you kind of apply, it's like the thing River Master Jiu would say about, in Buddhism there's the esoteric tradition, the Zen tradition, which starts with my effort, what I do will lead me to enlightenment. And then there's the exoteric traditions, which are like the Amida schools. You know, I'll call on the Buddha's name and it will bring me to enlightenment. So there's faith in this external power that's going to bring me to enlightenment. or faith on the internal power that's going to take me to enlightenment. She used to say, well, they're like entering two ends of the same tunnel. When you practice the self-powered practice, I'm going to be turned within and do my practice and all this stuff. You enter this tunnel and eventually you get to the point where you are coming out and you have faith in this, in that which is greater than you. And when you enter with the faith of calling on the Buddha, you realize that there's a lot of work in calling on the Buddha's name. And there's a lot of action that needs to be done before the Buddha will rescue you. And so you end up coming out, you know, kind of passing the middle and coming out the other end. And so I think that we can... So understanding that there's this idea, this emphasis on belief, and that we don't have that, it's not really necessary for you to believe in any particular doctrine and be a Buddhist. It's helpful to at least try them out and prove them true, and you will eventually see that they're useful, most likely, but you don't really have to believe in them. And so that may be the distinction that you're kind of pointing out there.
Something else. I guess another thing, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems as though the Western and Eastern as well point on faith. This kind of goes right along with what you guys were saying, but with the Western, it's this is what I believe, and now I believe it solidly, and now I'll go find out why I believe it. And then on the Eastern, it's like you find it out for yourself, and then you get to the conclusion that you kind of believe it, but you're willing to believe it all the way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, that's a, that. And I think maybe another way of explaining what
I just want
to
try to get it clear, though it's difficult sometimes.
It is difficult. It's useful, I think, to not have too, you know, it's useful to think about this in whatever way you find helpful, but it's useful to not have too rigid an idea about how the East views things or the West views things. Although, again, it is useful to understand that there are differences and to be able to see them clearly. Because, as I say, like in Buddhism, there are both the exoteric and the esoteric ways of practicing. So it's more of a human thing. What works well for one human being may not work so well for another human being. Yes?
I guess also could be that it seems there's a distinction between faith as a reinforcement of ego and faith as a means of kind of dissolving the ego, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, anything can be become an enhancement of the self. And when your faith is based on, when your faith doesn't include the idea of letting go, then you run the risk of it becoming a selfish pursuit. And the more rigidly we attach ourselves to doctrine, the more it's likely to be selfish. Eventually, though, the consequence of pursuing selfish things is suffering, and you... it becomes kind of so heavy and painful you have to kind of put it down. So it's kind of like the practice of generosity, where you, if you practice generosity to get something, then you will get a little bit of good consequence, and then there will also be some negative consequence because you're doing it out of greed. But if you continue to practice generosity, don't give up on it, and begin to let go of your greed, which is one of the consequences of practicing generosity, is becoming aware of when you're being greedy, then there's a kind of positive cycle going on. So even if you, what I'm trying to say is, even if you take up a religious doctrine which is has some grain of truth in it, and you put it into practice for selfish means, there will be good consequences from that. And hopefully one of the benefits of those good consequences is that you begin to see your selfishness. You see what I'm saying? And that's coupled with the idea that I'm trying to emphasize here of really studying the consequences that you receive from your actions. And in that way, you become an expert in your own self. This is what Dogen means by to study Buddhism is to study the self. By studying our own life and experience of consequences, we begin to see how we create self and how we can let go of self. And that's a good thing. That's becoming aware of self is not terribly pleasant, but it's a positive thing because it means, oh, I can let go of self.
Where does, I guess, doubt come in?
Sure, doubt. In a way, I think doubt is, it's a tricky thing depending on how you kind of deal with it. If you deal with doubt from the point of view of training and faith, then it's just another thing. If you give doubt any more, doubt is like anything. If you give it more of a, if you elevate it to more of a exalted status in your mind than anything else, then it will dominate your experience. So, but the same is true with, say, sexuality or political ambition or an angry response to things. Any of these things, if you allow them to become the focus of your way of being, will dominate your way of being. So doubt, to me, is just another thing to sit still with, to let it go, to examine, in a sense. Oh, that's interesting. There's doubt arising. What is that about? I'll sit still and neither hold on to that nor push it away. I'll sit still and see where it's coming from. Oftentimes doubt is based in fear. Oh, when you see, oh, doubt's based in fear, fear, I don't necessarily want to be dominated by fear. So I'm going to really let this go. I'm going to try not to be dominated by it. When you sit still in the midst of doubt, then you can learn something about your mind. You can learn something about how you react. One of the possible things about doubt, these days, there's a lot of religious practice is just not terribly popular, I'm sure you know. You've probably come across this someplace. You know, it's not going to be, your favorite Facebook conversation topic or anything like that. Well, maybe it will be, depending on who you are. But it's not terribly popular. So there's a lot of sort of scientific criticism of religious practice, which can cause people to doubt. So you sit still in that and you think, well, what's going on in that? Maybe there's some valid criticism of the way people all practice religion. I'll look at that and see. Do I want to throw out the whole baby with the bathwater, and do I want to just see where there's self in there? In the same way that I'm talking about taking up a doctrine and pursuing it rigidly and having that be selfish. Maybe I can learn something about my own way of that I'm making my religious practice selfish from this criticism. Or you can say, or it can be doubtful. Maybe when you're looking at yourself, say somebody's criticizing you and doubt arises in your mind and you sit still with that, maybe what's going on is you really want to be popular. You really want, like for me, I really want people to like me. God knows how I became a monk. With such a dominating koan of having what people like me. I was kind of fooling myself, I think, early on, kind of thinking, they'll really like the fact that I'm becoming a monk because I'm doing it for the benefit of all beings. Okay, early on, whatever you like. Maybe that's your deal. Maybe your deal is You want people to like you and support what you're doing. And so you have doubt because if you do your practice, people won't like you. That's what you might think. And, oh, there's, again, that's fear, you might say to yourself. And this is just speculating. I really have no idea, you know, what other people think. This is kind of from my experience. So you sit still with that and think, well, what is really true here? What do I feel in my heart that is true in terms of, you know, what I need to do? Say someone's criticizing you for giving 10% of your income to the church or whatever. Again, I'm not saying anybody should or shouldn't do any particular thing, but maybe that's the deal. And you think, or there's a story of one of the chief supporters of the Buddha. We can put it way back in history, so it's not doesn't have so many personal implications. Chief supporter of the Buddha, who's really taken with the practice of generosity. He's really kind of thinking, wow, this is really great. I'm finding this to be really helpful. And he basically just is really generous with the Sangha. So there's an economic downturn, and he loses a bunch of his, he's a merchant, he loses a bunch of his merchant ships in a big storm out to sea. And so he basically loses his fortune. And he's continuing to give things to the monks. He's made this commitment to the monks to support them. And the monks are all saying, oh, wait, don't make yourself broke on our behalf, which is good monastic practice. don't do that. But the fellow says, no, I feel like this is really important, so I'm going to keep giving to the Sangha. And he basically kind of nearly bankrupts himself because he feels that in his own heart that this is a good practice, even though everybody's saying, don't do this, including the monks. And eventually, he's a good enough merchant, he's able to turn things around and rebuild his fortune, even though he was continuing to be generous in that way, in that difficult situation. So, what I'm trying to say is, maybe you find yourself in a situation where everybody's saying, don't do X, Y, or Z, or don't be in X, Y, or Z way, or whatever, but you feel in your heart, this is from my practice and in consultation with the Dharma and everything, this is what is the true action for me to take. And so even though it may be that I will, like in my case, people won't like me, and partly becoming a monk, you know, it's a little miraculous because I did think, well, maybe people won't like me if I become a monk. And some people don't like me because I've become a monk. and yet, I still feel in my own heart, this is my path. This is the path for me. You see what I'm getting at? And in that way, it may be that people don't like me, but I can live with myself now. I can actually get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror and say, oh, it's you again. Hi. And that'll be, you know, fine. If you see what I'm getting at. And I feel better for that, for having not acted on my fear. So that's one of the possible things that doubt, one of the possible ways that doubt can go. But again, it's not just a simple matter of saying, don't doubt, you know, believe at all costs, go forward. It's a matter of meditation and experience, looking within, allowing your practice to open up, as you say, and deepen in that way, and see what is really true for you to do. Does that make sense?
The merchant story, I guess the opposite could happen as well. I mean, he could keep on giving and actually bankrupt himself.
Yes.
But through the habit and the practice of generosity, he, I guess, loses his attachment to that, I guess, that need, so.
Yes. And that's the thing that he came to realize. Yeah. It's just more important for me to give, even if the consequence is bankruptcy. I'll be willing to take that consequence. When it arises, you might not really like it very much, yeah. but chances are, you think, from my experience, I just think, okay, here it is. I'm doing it, and And I can still, like I say, get up in the morning and look at myself in the mirror and think, fair enough. And it's not that we're being naive or ingenuous. We're not trying to obscure the idea. We're not trying to make it into the... I'm not trying to convince anybody that by being really generous, eventually everything will work out and, you know, it'll be all happy and nice. Although, again, the result of practice is non-suffering.
And also, wouldn't that form of generosity kind of be selfish as well?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that street... It may be that there's an attachment that causes you to give in that way to such an extreme. And then you learn, oh man, I was dumb, or whatever. So, again, it's just a matter of continuing to turn within, take refuge in the three treasures, take refuge in our meditation, see what's true for us in the present moment.
Listen to Self-Reliance yesterday from Emerson, and where he talked about consistency and the idea that people not being attached to consistency rather than, you know, be attached to truth.
Right.
When you talk about what's true for us in the present moment, it's not always constant.
Yeah, that's one of that kind of basic principles of Zen practice. Sometime it may be one thing may be true, sometime another thing may be true. We're not trying to be unconstant, and there's a way that you can misconstrue there's a way that you can kind of
wishy-washy.
Be wishy-washy and not committed you can take that principle and have it become self as well. And, you know, you can say, oh, it's okay for me to do this now because I'm not being, you know, consistent. I'm not being attached to being consistent or whatever. And there's an equal danger in there. Most of the time, people who you meet who embody true practice, and by that I don't mean, you know, just Buddhism or just Buddhist practice, but kind of authentic life, you will discover that they are in some respects boringly consistent, almost invariably. There's a kind of, some of the people I have greatest admiration for in the Sangha are people who are just, who just show up every time, every day, just consistent, and you don't see attachment in them. You just see this kind of devotion, and that it's just deeply, it's kind of profoundly impressive. So, you have to be kind of careful about that, and remember that the quote. There's a famous quote. A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. Oftentimes the quote is, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. But what he actually said was, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds.
So, I mean, does foolish consistency then, is that predicated on unconscious habit then? Where an actual genuine consistency is foundation is mindfulness, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a good way to put it. Yeah, that a wise consistency is based on that, again, that deepening awareness of what is, and that practice of continually bring yourself back to the present and exploring the consequences of actions. Okay, well, it's getting on. Hopefully that was useful. Thank you for your patience and help.